Yes.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Tillip, in the waiting room, which is not part of the proceedings at the moment.
Hello?
Ms. Tillip is in the waiting room, so she can't hear what is happening.
Oh, okay. Oh, they're in the waiting room.
Yeah.
Okay. Honorable Chanchi, good morning.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, colleagues.
Good morning, everyone.
I think we should start with the meeting. First of all, let me start by thanking all members, especially members of the opposition, for their words of comfort and support during the difficult time that we faced as the committee, as a study group of the African National Congress. We received a message from all of you, messages of comfort. We really appreciate it. You were our brothers and sisters in times of, in a time of need. We really do appreciate it, and would like to say, let's continue with that spirit of brotherly and sisterly words. Members, as you would know, that Comrade Hisham has departed, who was the whip of the African National Congress. The ANC has appointed Comrade Jackie Mofokeng as the whip of the ANC. We would like to welcome and congratulate her on her appointment. It was made yesterday. I will allow her to make few words before we allow Honorable Breitenbach to raise the issues that she wanted to raise. Honorable Mofokeng.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. Thank you very much. And maybe I should start by saying to thank my organization for the confidence they've shown in me, but I'm looking forward to work with all of you and with the spirit that we've been having. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Before we start with the proceedings, Honorable Breitenbach, you said you wanted to raise two quick issues.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everybody. And congratulations to the ANC whip. Bear in mind that she's the ANC whip in the committee and not the committee whip. There are one or two issues with regards to these interviews that we're going to do this morning. So are the candidates not on the platform at the moment?
I've been advised as such.
Okay.
Who are we? Y7 Pro? Committee Secretary, can you check? Okay, Mr. Okay, Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you. Sorry, my dogs are not going to keep quiet. The issue of the security vetting of these candidates, has that been dealt with? And do we have the outcome thereof? I'm a little concerned about interviewing people if we don't know what's going to happen with the vetting process. We may conduct interviews and there may be a problem with the vetting. Probably not, but nevertheless, it's a possibility, and we postponed these interviews specifically for the vetting process. So if we could have sight of the outcome of the vetting before we start the interviews, that would be helpful. And then Mr. Self's apologies, please, he's not able to make the meeting today. Thanks.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think we will start with that one. I think I will ask Bonani or SEA to circulate the outcomes. We received the results yesterday from SSA, which indicated that for all the candidates, there are no issues, there are no security issues, the qualifications have been verified, and the credit records have also been verified. But I think it would be important that Ms. Mtunjin or Mr. Raman or Mr. Mtunjin, if you can circulate those results to members. But I was assured yesterday that everything from the security side has been cleared.
Okay, then may I say something further, please?
Okay.
So, I mean, in fairness, that should have been circulated when you received it. For us to receive it now is really very short notice to go through it and have a good look at it. And it's important. You know, we postponed these interviews precisely for that purpose, and if they were received yesterday, I can't imagine why the committee members didn't receive it yesterday as well. But be that as it may, it's water under the bridge. We also, I see we're only interviewing four candidates. And I think we shortlisted more. Can we find out what happened to those that we're not interviewing that we shortlisted? Did they withdraw, or on what basis are they being excluded? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are these all the questions before we give a briefing?
Those are my questions. I'm not sure if Honourable Horne has anything he wants to add.
Okay, Steve here as well. Swart.
Okay. Honourable Swart.
No, Chair, I just wanted to find out whether these interviews are going to be, I presume they're not being broadcast on any parliamentary platform at the moment, just because of the sensitivity of the questions, but normally interviews are broadcast at some stage for public knowledge, but I just wanted clarity in that regard.
Okay. Any other questions? Sia and Wanani?
Sorry, Chair. Sorry, I just also forgot to congratulate Ms. Jackie Mofokeng from our side as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ramano or Mr. Mtunjeni, can you take us through the number of people who were shortlisted and those who withdrew and the reasons?
Good morning, Chair. We shortlisted five candidates, and then one of the candidates withdrew because she of her responsibility. She's quite good at the moment to participate in this process.
So, which means we have four candidates to be interviewed today.
Yes, Chair.
And then also the issue of the issue raised by Mr. Swart about whether the interviews have been broadcasted.
They are not live at the moment, Chair. Don't think Parliament will be broadcasting them.
Okay. Honourable members, we are going to be interviewing four candidates. We are going to be following the same process we followed with the interview of the Deputy Public Protector. Can I take this opportunity to ask Christine to take us through the proposed questions? The proposed questions would be a guide, would not be prescriptive. But we have she has developed a list of questions covering various parts to check the suitability of the candidates. There are about 33 questions. After she has gone through the questions, we would discuss how many questions will each member be entitled to, bearing in mind the number of people who are present, and I take it that we will be able to ascertain the number of members who will be present by 10, and then it will be, I think by that time we'll be able to know, to be able to divide the questions. If I might recap from the interviews of the Deputy Public Protector, we allowed each member a maximum of 5 minutes each, not exceeding that, because we would want at least to spend a maximum of an hour with each candidate, so that at least by two we should be done. That is that on my side. If there are no questions, I would ask Christine or Ms. Silstone to take us through the questions. And just have all members received the questions?
No, Chair.
Chair, for clarity, is that the parliamentary document that I have received, that it was circulated? I think it's the standard parliamentary document with questions that are put out. Although it's specific for this issue, but it is on a parliamentary letter front page.
Yes. Yes.
You should flag them, Chair, now that we're here. Is it possible that you can flag the questions, at least? That's why we're meeting.
Yes, I think they would be flighted, but also members would receive a document. We thought that we must release as each member come, so that we don't have a document for interviews circulated to members who would not be part of the panel. So I think the document has been flighted. Christine, can you ensure that all members receive the document assisted by the committee secretariat? And then can you take us through the questions?
Yes, yes, of course. I'm going to ask either Sio or Benani just to scroll through, because it's a bit difficult for me to use the document that's on your screen. So I'm going to work from my Word document. So the first part is a part for the chairperson, and it's really just about giving the candidate time to an opportunity to just settle in and explain who they are. So it's the first one. Hypothetically, imagine that you're appointed. How would you convince this committee that you are able to step into the role? And in doing so, please tell us about who you are, your values, and your experience. And then the next one is around the question around fit and proper. Do you believe you're a fit and proper person? Explain why. And then there's a follow-up question around disclosure. And the next two parts, the next few questions are also around the candidate's personal skills, or who they are and the skills that they have. So as a member of the information regulator, do you have, you would need to have leadership skills, but be prepared to work with other members, accountable to the chairperson of the regulator. And then how would you describe your leadership style? How would people who have worked with you previously describe you? If you are appointed, would you be able to manage your present responsibilities and your new responsibilities of being a part-time member of the regulator? Please elaborate. Many of our candidates here have got other responsibilities, part-time member we're appointing, and we don't really want to have somebody so committed that they're not able to pay attention to this position. If you're appointed, does your interest lie with data protection services or access to information? That's just kind of testing which area they're slightly more interested in, or both, and why. And again, if you're appointed, what would you want to do with your legacy? And the next section tests the knowledge of the role of the information regulator. So what do you understand the role of the information regulator? Regulated to be? What specific matters does the Act require the information regulator to have regard to when performing its functions and exercising its powers? That's also just testing that they've actually looked at the Act and that they know what they're applying for and what they would need to be doing. The next question, number 10, it's around about it's testing how they think that they can contribute, particularly to the regulator at this time, as it prepares for Popular becoming fully operational from next year, July. And then why do you think that the Act requires information regulator to be both independent and impartial? Again, this is testing their knowledge of the role of the information regulator and why it's important to this position that there needs to be a certain amount of care, or there needs to, it needs to be independent and impartial. What in your view are some of the key challenges or risks that the information regulator faces as it goes about establishing itself, and what are your suggested mitigation strategies? So this is testing how much they know about the information regulator, its capacity, some of its challenges, and so on. In the current economic climate, budget constraints represent a very real challenge. In your view, how can the information regulator be innovative in executing its mandate? Public awareness and education about the role of the regulator is critical. As a part-time member, how would you ensure that the regulator is able to reach and be reached by all South Africans? Information is communicated in a user-friendly, easily understood manner, including to people with disabilities. Do you believe that the information regulator should be included in government discussions about the digital economy and the fourth industrial revolution? If so, why? The next section is questions particularly around privacy and protection of personal information. In your view, why is there a need for legislation to protect personal information? What is it that POPIA aims to do? What responsibilities do responsible parties, sorry, there's a word missing there, have when processing information, personal information? What remedies do data subjects have? What is special personal information and why is it treated differently? What are the main threats or risks that individuals what are the main threats or risks to individuals concerning their information, personal information? Sorry, that's also a wrong word. What concerns or particular concerns have been expressed about communication surveillance and misuse of people's personal data? Please discuss. Question number 24 is around the Experian data breach. This is not the first time that a data breach has resulted in the personal information of South Africans becoming public. Please explain how data protection laws can protect the personal information of data subjects. Do you believe that the commencement of certain sections of POPIA can create new economic opportunities for South Africa? Next year South Africa is holding a government election, and the elections by their nature require all the different role party players to process lots of personal data. And digital campaigning is here to stay. And that it's important that personal data is processed. Please discuss this. That's just testing their knowledge of the issues around personal data and elections. Question 27. This is linking to that with COVID-19, there's been many data breaches or concerns. And one major response globally is to curb the spread of COVID-19 is contact tracing, which is a practice of identifying and monitoring individuals who may have come into contact with an infected person. What are some of the data protection concerns you've identified? And then it's just really discussing that. And then the number of people on the African continent using the internet has increased. And at the same time, there's increasing concern about the disregard for personal data by social media networks, the prominence of fake news, and the growth of cybercrime. Maintaining a balance between protecting citizens from cybercrime and ensuring their internet freedoms is challenging. In your view, what role does the regulator have in maintaining this balance? So that's testing the balance between privacy and transparency. The next section just posts the knowledge about the promotion of access to information PAIEA. So a PAIEA also extends certain responsibilities around PAIEA to the information regulator. And in your view, why is the right of access to information so important? PAIEA is key to the realization of the constitutional objectives of transparency and open government. In your view, how effective has PAIEA been in achieving this objective since its implementation in 2001. What is your understanding of the challenges relating to access to information in South Africa? Questions 30 and 31 are actually quite similar. And then in June, this is around the president signed a significant amendment to the two-payer. Its overall objective is to promote transparency in the private funding of political parties and to combat corruption. What is your understanding of the implications of this amendment? Again, this is the 33 is around testing your knowledge around challenges. So the Human Rights Commission has expressed its concern around the right of access to information not being fully realized, consistently realized. The information regulators taking over the Human Rights Commission's functions, or some of them. In your view, how can the information regulator ensure that there's improved compliance with PAGIA? The process for accessing information in PAGIA is cumbersome, and they're not easily accessible to community. As a part-time member of the regulator, what steps would you initiate to enhance community access to PAGIA? And the information regulator will need to find a proper balance between its responsibilities and with regard to data protection and providing recourse to those claiming a right of access to information. Please comment. So those are our questions. Sorry, I'm just trying to get back to you. Hello?
As we are trying to...
Hello? Oh, did I lose you entirely?
No.
Okay. I thought I'd been kicked out and I was talking to nobody. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I think it will be important to keep the screen, in fact, the presentation on the screen. I think let's try and keep questions short, because I will be receiving questions the very same morning. To internalize a paragraph or so of a question is not assisting. So I think it will be important in order to keep questions very pointed, so that members can be able to internalize those questions that they want to ask. Over to you, members. Honourable Swart.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the draft questions. They're very helpful. The one challenge is that we distribute those, and I think we probably would just go along the process like we did before. I just wanted your clarity. The 5 minutes, if I remember correctly, also included the responses. So one will probably have an order of people asking questions, and then I don't know if we will have the time now to allocate questions, but probably the members would want to ask questions from this list. The one challenge I've got now is access to this list, which we might have to discuss. I've tried to take screenshots of the questions that I've got, some of them, but I would think to propose that, I don't know, Chair, if you had another thought, but that we allow people to ask questions, and then that would exclude that certain question from the next member unless it wasn't properly answered, given the fact that there is very limited time. But I'm very appreciative of these draft questions, but I do tend to agree with you that given the limited time, to put quite long paragraphs might be a challenge.
Thank you, Honourable Swart. My understanding is that the questions have been emailed to members. So the question would be whether you have received the questions. We asked Christine to email questions to members as they arrive. So if you can open your email address, I think you will find the questions. I think the I think if we are happy generally with the questions, not word by word, we would members can indicate so that we can go to the allocation of questions. Honourable Janji.
Chair, no, just quick things because we don't have much time. I think it might help in future just to, instead of 30 minutes, at least we've got an hour of such a session if we're going to get questions in the morning, not 30 minutes because a large part of that has been taken by the presentation already. So I want to suggest, Chair, for myself, yes, I've just checked, I've received the email now of the questions. For the 5 minutes that will be allocated to myself, Chair, I just want to indicate that I will deal with questions 13, 14, 27, and 33, and the question...
Is question 13?
Question 13, 14, 27, and 33. That's my 5 minutes. I'm fine. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Chair Wilmer.
Comrade Verma.
Thank you, Chair. I can't, let me just change the screen quickly. Okay. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to recommend most members have cell phones and WhatsApp. So maybe these questions can be sent as a document on WhatsApp that we can read there to make it easier. Maybe it's just a thought another way instead of the emailing to our devices that we might not be able to use. My question is, I have five questions. Do I ask all five at one time or is it back and forth? Because some people might switch off their camera. So I need to switch on my camera to ask the question. Do I ask all five at the same time? So I'm not sure if it's back and forth. If I get the opportunity, then I would like to ask question 17, 18, 21, 25 and 31.
Yeah. What's going on here now?
What's the problem?
Mr. Chair, are we now getting to pick what questions we want to ask and those who push in the queue first get to pick their questions, the rest of us take what's left over or what? How are we going to deal with this? We just pick questions?
I thought we would pick questions so the members would indicate which questions they are comfortable with. What they want to ask.
Sorry, Chair, Steve's here. I wasn't aware of that. And maybe we should limit the selection of questions then to maybe two or three, given that the time is very limited. But obviously, the challenge is then how do we allocate, as Honourable Breitenbach has pointed out. So I'll wait my turn because I've already had an opportunity to speak. But we'll be guided by you.
Chair, it's Werner Hoorn. I don't want to comment now on as the Honourable Breitenbach says, people jumping the queue and then monopolising questions. I think rather the issue is the following. We've set aside an hour for every candidate. And we must also consider whether we're going to be asking, apart from follow-ups, the exact same questions to all candidates. Just by listening to the number of questions the Honourable Jainki and the Honourable Nivo Dragan has indicated they want to ask, it's quite possible that if they go first, that will take the hour. And that's now apart from considering whether we want to assess candidates by asking the very same questions of all of them.
Chair, can I assist the chair before you?
Honourable Janji?
You guided us. This is not for the first time we're going through an interview. You guided us and said we had a template how we dealt with the issue of the Deputy Public Protector. And part of that template said each member has got 5 minutes. To ask, that 5 minutes, you're in control of that 5 minutes. Now you've got over 30 questions, 28 plus kind of questions. And we are this number of MPs. I don't have a problem even if Breitenbach or Vernahon and others can start choosing. There's going to be questions left for everybody. So the issue is not there's a stampede about which questions you ask. But for my I've got 5 minutes, and in that 5 minutes, I'm going to make sure that I use that time. The person, I ask, she responds, I ask, she responds. We've done this before. So I don't want us as if we're starting to do this for the first time.
Thank you very much. I think Honorable Jolly.
Thank you very much. Maybe are you going to, I just want to find out, are you going to give us those numbers also? Which one am I take? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable members, I think a person who indicates which questions to ask must make sure that he is not very fast, so that we don't have one question being asked by more than one person. Secondly, I think we would need to agree on the cap, the number of questions within that 5 minutes. And I think it will be important that we start allocating those questions, because I think with the number of people we have now, I don't think that we are going to be, we'll ask all the questions even if we want to. I don't think we will pick all the questions. I think there is more than enough for all of us. So already I have Honorable Janji, Honorable Velma, anyone else wants to indicate?
Yes.
Honorable Ngola?
Firstly, I want to request that I keep my camera off for signal and audibility purposes. To say, I would like to enter in the fit and the proper person question, which is number 2.
That is for the chair. Honorable Ngola?
Sorry, for the chair.
So that is for the chair.
Yes, chair. Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes. Okay. I'm saying number 2 is for the chairperson.
Yes, chair.
Yes.
But I think in terms of how it is structured.
Okay.
Well, it is asking one, does the candidate think that he or she is a fit and a proper person?
Mm.
I'm not sure if we're allowed, Chair, to make a follow-up on it, on their understanding of what is a fit and a proper person.
Can you make a follow-up?
Yes, Chair. And number 16, Chair, the one that is speaking on the digital economy and the fourth industrial revolution. Am I still audible, Chair? Am I still audible, Chair?
Well, you are, but the chair is not answering you.
Okay.
I think we've lost the chair.
Yeah. We are a chairless committee.
Yeah, bro.
We are chairless.
Can somebody indicate which questions have now been taken already so that the rest of us can decide what we want to ask?
Yes. Honorable members, I'm back. Number 13, number 14, number 27 and 33. Is Honorable Janji. 17, 18, 21, 25, 31 is Honorable Velma. And then we have Honorable Ngola, who wanted to make a follow-up.
Hello?
On, hello?
Sorry, repeat again the Comrade Velma. There are a few ones that I missed. 17 and what?
18, 21, 25, and 31.
Okay.
Honorable Ngola, number 2, follow up on number 2. Can you proceed, Ngola?
Yes, I can see that the South African human rights question on concern 33 and one of the judges already grabbed it. But it's fine, Chair. For now, I'm still fine with this follow-up and the digital economy one. I will see which one to add as well.
Number. Can we just talk about numbers because we want to save time?
Oh, okay. It is a follow-up on 2, Chair. Then it is number 16. For now, I'm still fine because number 33 is already taken by one of the judges.
Chair Swart, Chair?
And I'm off the spot, please, because I'm never going to get a turn here, obviously.
after you.
No, let's have order.
No, there's no order because everyone's just doing a free flow.
Honorable Swart?
Chair, I missed the numbers that were, but I just want to ask, and then you can tell me if it's already been allocated. It is 23, 26, 27, 28.
Only 27 taken.
So then it's 23, 26, 28.
I think, honourable members, generally we can still phrase a question differently. It would be the same question.
That's fine, Chair. If I've got time, I will come back to 27 to rephrase it. But at this stage, 23, 26, 28.
28, okay. Honourable Glenys Breitenbach.
Thank you. I'd like, ones that I'd like have all been taken, but I'll take 6 and 10.
6 and 10.
Because those who are asking 5 and 6 questions each will take up the rest of the time. There's not enough time for everybody to ask 10 questions.
Well, in your 5 minutes, you can, because if a person has 5 questions, but within 5 minutes he was able to ask 3 questions, he would not be able to proceed to ask the rest of the questions. Everybody's going to be limited by time.
Okay, fine.
Honorable Noma Temba?
I'll take 15 and then take 22. And 25, trying to be short, 25. I took 26, so now Honorable Swart has already taken it.
So you know that so, Honorable Lima is also taking 25. But you'll be able to listen and rephrase the question if you want to.
The 26, because it was 26.
25 is Honorable Velma, 26 is Honorable Swart.
Yes, this one of honorable son. I'll check out how to phrase it.
Okay.
Chair, it's Honorable Wilma.
Honorable Wilma.
I would like to give over 25 to Honorable Jale. And then I can reduce, maybe 5 questions is too much. So Honorable Jale is welcome to have question 25. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Janja.
Just to make it easy, Chair, I'm going to remain with 13 and 14. Ngola can take 33, Mark can take 27. I'm fine with just 2 questions in my 5 minutes. Thank you.
Ngola, did you hear that?
Yes, Chair, and all of the Janji is a force.
Okay. Honorable Swart.
Sorry. Yes. Can I then, if Honorable Janji gives me 27, then I can offer 26 to the honourable member that asked for that. Sorry, I missed.
Okay, and then Honourable Horn.
Okay.
Okay. It seems to me all the lotter numbers have been taken. I'll maybe go for a quick pick towards the end. If you'll allow me, if you be strict on the time limits.
Yes.
You can slot me in last so that I don't miss my opportunity, and then I'll try and cover something that has not been covered.
Oh, yeah, you'll be a sweeper.
Okay.
Well,
you must pick questions, Chair. There's no general sweeper. Yet.
Well, we're also not We're also not necessarily only fixated on the question suggested. So if it's satisfied, the Honourable Jayanki, I'll ask my own question.
That's true. No, that's fine. We agreed that the questions are a general guide. That's fine. Can we start with the meeting, Honourable Members? We're 11 minutes late. I forgot the whip of the ANC. Honourable
19 and 24. In fact, I picked up, I had 20 and 22 that has been taken, but I only take 24 and 19 only. And then I will look at follow ups on other questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Have we covered everybody?
Chair, Swati, I wanted to just ask you another quick question.
Yes.
I just need to disclose that Ms. Tilly, I am an acquaintance of her for many years. I don't know if other members need to disclose that, but at some stage I need to do that as well. No, thank you.
I think once we have started with the interviews, I think when we interview her, you will have to disclose at that point.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Members, are we now fine that we can start?
Yes, please.
Very much. Thank you very much. What I can say, Honourable Members, is that before lunch, we would need to discuss some correspondences that I would ask Bonani to distribute to you. One is from the Eastern Cape about some domestic circumstances that would need our attention. And then I think if Bonani can distribute that to me. And then also, if we remember during the budget votes, we asked for a breakdown of the Zondo Commission expenditure. I would also ask that that be distributed to members. Okay, let's start. Let's start. Committee Secretariat. Let's start at quarter past 2 minutes break so that we can be able to switch over to invite the first candidate.
Chairperson? Chair? Chairperson?
Honourable Jackie?
Can we request that I can hear cell phones of other people in different ways, those that are not speaking to mute, because it's going to be difficult, the weather is not okay, and we might lose each other somewhere.
Okay, that is in order. Can you try and mute our phones?
Hello? Why am I... Everyone is quiet.
We are left alone.
Quiet.
We must mute, so we're muted. That's why everyone's quiet.
Yeah, we're all quiet.
The chair is locked again.
No, the chair has proposed a 2 minute break until quarter past. That's for us to let the candidate in. We are trying that now.
Oh, okay.
who is the first person to be interviewed? Wenan?
Chair, the first candidate is Ms. Alison Tilly.
Ms. Alison Tilly, is she in the room?
She is, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Tilly, good morning.
Good morning, Chairperson.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Thank you very much. We will start by introducing ourselves to you. I'm not sure whether you can see me.
Yes, I can, sir.
My name is Bulelani Gratitude Magwanishe. I'm the chair of the committee. The next member, Honorable Dennis Breitenbach. Can you introduce yourself?
Good morning, I'm Glynis Breitenbach. I'm a member of the committee, and I do know Ms. Tilly, not sufficiently well to have to consider recusing myself, but I do know Ms. Tilly. We do know each other from the workings of Parliament.
Thank you very much. The next member? Honorable number 10.
Okay. I'm Jacqueline Mofokeng, member of the committee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Nomathemba. Hello.
Hello.
I'm Nomathemba Masekutele, member of this committee, ANC.
Okay. Another member?
I'm Honorable Woman Yuho Drufin. And the voice you hear is not mine, it's of the sign language interpreter, Dolphin. Thank you.
Okay. We've just seen the sign language interpreter. We did not see Honorable Novo Trichens. Can you see you, Honorable Trichens?
Chair, the host has to put Honorable Wilma on spotlight. The host has the controls to that, to spotlight Honorable Wilma. Thank you.
When we do that, we'll come back to Honorable Nipot Trachan's other members.
Hey.
Morning, Chair. Go ahead, Ren.
No, you go ahead, Steve.
Morning, Chair. Steve Swart. I also know Ms. Tilly, but I don't think it's necessary for me to recuse myself, and looking forward to the interview. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Chair Werner Horn, I'm also a member of the committee, and since 2014 I've known Ms. Tilly as someone taking a keen interest in this portfolio's work and also around the work she does as judges matter. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Here's Mr. Honorable Verma. I think we can see her. Thank you very much.
Am I in spotlight? Yes. Chair, just to introduce myself again, I'm Honourable Woman Yuho Drufin. I use sign language, so the voice that you hear is not mine, it is that of the interpreter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Janje.
My name is Kubudile Richard Janje, member of the committee. I recognize the face because she always makes herself a nuisance in the meeting committee meetings and the magistrate commission, so I always bump into her. I'm not excusing myself because she just throws herself into the committees. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mola.
Thank you very much, Chair. I am Honorable Tola Ngola. I am the member of the committee. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Are we done with the with all the members?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tilly, Good morning. I hope you are well. I will be asking you two questions as the chair. The first one, how would you convince this committee that you will be able to step into this role as a part-time member of the information regulator? Coupled with that, can you please tell us about who you are, your values, and your experience?
Yes, Chair. So perhaps I should start with a little bit about who I am. I'm an attorney by training and started my work life as an attorney in a law firm and then moved to the Black Sash shortly after democracy and started working for them as a representative for them in Parliament. And they were very exciting years. We had the new constitution being written, and we also had a range of new legislation being passed. And I was responsible for helping the organization to formulate its views on various issues from the death penalty to the Human Rights Commission, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We put those submissions forward, and you'd be very familiar with this process in that committee where organizations come and they give you their views on issues in order to strengthen the hand of the committee in terms of writing good constitutional legislation. Subsequent to that, I joined, founded really the Open Democracy Advice Center and worked there from 2001 until 2018, working on issues around access to information and whistleblowing. I also work with other organizations such as Rape Crisis in order to support their advocacy work. And I'm currently the coordinator of the Judges Matter campaign, which is a transparency campaign around judicial appointments for both high court judges and now also for magistrates. So that's a little bit about who I am. I think that in terms of the values that I would bring to this position, I have really found my place over the last 20 years working in a space where we can advance the values of the Constitution. I think of those are most importantly the values that we must all have in common. And I think that that's really where I would say that my values can be found. I am also, I think the values around integrity and honesty are very important to me. I think those are probably the two values that I personally would regard as very important. As to convincing the committee that I would be able to step into the role, I think I've been very engaged in how both pieces of legislation that the regulator is responsible for have been written. I'm in relation to the Protection of Personal Information Act. I was a member of the South African Law Reform Commission committee that worked on shaping the legislation, giving it sort of philosophical underpinnings, and then helping to write it so that it takes its current form. That does also mean that I do feel partly responsible for where there are problems with some of the parts of the legislation. And I think at the moment there are certainly amendments that perhaps the Access to Information Act needs to see, given that it was drafted so long ago and that there really have been enormous changes in the environment that we are in terms of information. So I think I've been thinking about the issues and trying to translate the principles into practice, and then also trying to explain to ordinary people how to use these pieces of legislation, because there's no point in having a beautifully crafted law if people don't understand it, see how it's important to them, and see how they can use it. And I think that that's something that I have been doing extensively. It's interesting and challenging, but I think there's a lot more work to do around
that. Thank you very much. My 5 minutes is up. Honorable Ngola, I think you can take over question two. Honorable Ngola.
Thank you very much, sir. What is your understanding of fit as a proper testing?
I'm sorry, that broke up for me. I couldn't hear it clearly. I wonder if I could ask you to repeat it, Honorable Tola.
Thank you. I'm saying, what is your understanding of a fit and a proper testing?
A fit and proper person. Thank you. That's a very interesting question, which comes up a lot in the Judicial Services Commission, as to what is fit and proper. And I think the answers in the commission tend to focus around issues like integrity, demonstrating adherence to the values of the Constitution. Obviously, in that context, you're looking to make sure that people have a track record and have been, in that particular case, because they're all attorneys or advocates or magistrates, that they've been admitted to the profession. There's often the argument that simply because you've been admitted to the profession, you must be a fit and proper person. And I would disagree with that. I would think it would be the track record that you show in relation to performing your work.
Another one.
Yes, Chair.
You can proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me go to you. Believe that content regulators should be included in cabinet discussions about the and the fourth in the first proceeding.
I'm sorry, Chair. I'm not sure if it's only me, but I'm struggling to hear that.
No, Chair. We also can't hear him.
Chair, can you hear me now?
Yes, Honourable Gola, I can hear you now.
Thank you. Do you believe that the information regulator should be included in the government discussions about the digital economy and the fourth industrial revolution? If the answer is affirmative, why do you believe so?
I believe very firmly that the information regulator needs to be involved in discussions around the fourth industrial revolution. I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that the fourth industrial revolution is being driven in large part by personal data. And, you know, there's the saying where people say, well, personal data is the new oil. So it's something that you can actually use to get rich from. And I think that we are, it's very important for us to realize that. And for the regulator to really make sure that from the Protection of Personal Information Act's point of view, that people's personal data is taken care of. The exploitation of personal data and of people, I think, is going to be a feature and is already a feature of the fourth industrial revolution, which is happening around us. I think we saw that in the CPS, the case involving the black sash and the abuse of personal data in relation to grants. And I think that that's a very good example of how people's personal data can be abused. The fourth industrial revolution is happening whether we like it or not. There's nothing I think we can do to stop it. We have to work with it, but we have to take it seriously. And I think one of the key features of 4IR is going to be the use of personal data for a whole range of things, including, I think, involving manipulating elections, which I think we've seen in a number of jurisdictions, a number of other jurisdictions. So I think it's something that the IR really does need to be, definitely needs to be included in discussions around those issues, and it is, I think it is urgent.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tilly. The next question will come from Honorable Dennis Breitenbach.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Tilly.
Morning, Honorable Breitenbach.
The first question I have for you is, if you are appointed, does your interest lie with data protection or access to information or both, and briefly why? I can ask the second question now or sure. When you've done this answer. I'll do it when you've done with this answer.
Okay. Yes, I'm afraid I am interested in both. I think both are very important. And your question is why I'm interested in both, or sorry, can I just...
Yeah, my question is why would you have a specific preference? And if you don't have a preference, why do you have the overall interest?
That's a hard question to answer. I suppose it's because I think information is very, very important. I think what we know and how we know it is really foundational for people in a democracy. I think that a democracy is only really possible in an environment where people know and understand the world around them. And it's a very important part of empowering citizens to participate in democracy. But I also think, and that's the sort of the other side of it, is that people also have a right to privacy. They have a right not to be watched by the state unless it is appropriate, and and that should only happen in certain controlled situations. So I think it's very much a discussion about power and democracy and how all of these things work together so that we have the right kinds of systems. I think it's also one of those things that a lot of people agree on, which is also certainly for access to information. It's something that a lot of people are enthusiastic about if you can talk to them about it in the right way. And that's something I really enjoy about access to information, and that right is that I think people can feel it immediately for themselves, how important that is and how empowered they can be if they have the access to the right information. So I suppose it's for a range of reasons.
Thank you very much. The second question is on the 1st of July 2020, the remaining sections of POPIA became effective, but there is a grace period of 1 year for responsible parties to become compliant. If you're appointed, you will join the regulator at a time when it must shift its focus from capacitation to implementation. Shut up. How do you think you would be able to contribute?
Well, I think there are a couple of things I would be able to do. And I'm pretty familiar with and confident in doing outreach work, training and capacitating people in civil society and in government as well. I have had that opportunity. to understand how the right to access to information works, how PIA works. I've done less work on PUPI, but I think particularly in relation to local government, that's something that is very, very sorely needed. I reviewed the Human Rights Commission report on access to information last night, and there are 3 pages of municipalities that are simply not complying with the PIA requirements. And I think that would probably be a good place to see if you couldn't get some quick wins there. The more local government understands information as important, the better, and that they're then able to put those systems in place. So I think that's one of the things I would like to suggest should be an immediate priority in the run up to the start.
Thank you very much.
So Honourable Breitenbach, you still had a minute left. I'm not sure whether you would want to use it or to give it to Honourable Horn.
I'll give it to Honourable Horn.
No, but it can even be given to Janji. Why Horn?
Honourable Janji, you are next.
Thank you very much, Chair. Ms. Alison Tilly, I have 5 minutes that I'm in charge, that I'm going to control. You are in control of the answers and the content. So let's just do this. I've got just 2 questions where I want to get the best from you on this. What, in your view, are the key challenges and the risks that this baby, this information regulator that is emerging, it's not an established institution, that it is facing? What are those key challenges and risks? And if you can just give me 1 or 2 and pair that with what would you develop as mitigating strategies to deal with those? Can you go?
Thank you, Arnold. I think the key challenge right now for the regulator is that it has been in operation for 4 years, and that its legislation has not come into operation, and the regulator has had no powers during that period. So I think the appointment of the regulator was the point at which...
You would agree with me that 4 years is already too long, eh?
I would completely agree with you, sir, and I would say that I think that it has undermined the credibility of the regulator and undermined the getting that legislation being taken seriously, because I think people have looked at it and said, well, the regulator's there now, what are they doing? And of course, that's not the regulator's fault. They haven't been able to act. And I think that is a perhaps not even a risk, that is a current challenge that is going to, it really does need to be addressed if the regulator is going to be taken seriously. And I think it must be if that legislation is going to be made real made real on the ground. I think one of the things that, as I say, I'm particularly concerned about local government and the lack of implementation in local government. I think if the regulator was in a position where there was engagement with local government and encouragement to get local government to make information made proactively available, so you don't have to wait and get the form and then respond to the form and pay your 35 rand and go through that process. If you had a sense that the information regulator came to your municipality and helped them make information proactively available on websites or on billboards or, you know, painting it on walls. I mean, there's some very interesting and creative stuff that's come out of Kenya around budgeting, where you literally take the budget and you paint it on a wall, and then people can see what it is. It doesn't have to be high tech. But I think that's the risk that I think is a really clear and present issue. And getting the regulator out there and making information available is a way to mitigate that.
Okay. And maybe linked to that, we operate in an environment of constrained budget. We have nothing in terms of resources almost, but there's just so much that must be done. So there's more demand and less supply in terms of the kind of tools and the resources that we have. We are in that context, and COVID, as you know, has worsened that. Now, I would want you to just share one or two. What are the kind of strategies that you would introduce, suggest to innovate and ensure that we have we successfully pursue the mandate of this in a constrained environment where there's nothing to start from in terms of your budget? You're going to get into that space if you're successful, and they'll tell you we don't have budget. How would we succeed in that environment?
Well, I think in some ways what the pandemic has given us, and it's a very small silver lining against the many, you know, the many deaths and economic devastation of the pandemic. But we are becoming more used to working online, and I think that something, for example, if you had, for example, a meeting of all the information officers, the deputy information officers from all the government departments. I mean, if you'd said to me 3 years ago, how much will that cost? I would have been calculating flights and travel and hotel and all of that. But now I'm sure-ish that people would be able to participate in a meeting of all of those people, and we would be able to do it like this. And that's obviously, you know, it still means people have to have laptops and, you know, offices and internet and all of that. But I think you're able to do things in that way that perhaps we wouldn't have seen before as being, you know, something that would be so doable. And I think the other thing is a lot of things don't cost money. You know, if you
thank
get
you very
across,
much.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tilly. The first
step of care to ask Ms. Tilly nicely, just switch off everything that is there with you and all of those phones. Just switch them off. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Velma.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good afternoon to everyone. Good afternoon or good morning, Ms. Tilly. In your view, in plain language that people on the ground can understand, can you explain to us why there is a need for the legislation to protect personal information?
Yes, thank you for that question. I think people sometimes imagine that it's only rich people who need their privacy protected, but that's absolutely not true. People's information is being gathered all the time, and particularly things like ID numbers. And once you have access to somebody's ID number and you're able to access the databases that they are part of, you can then do all sorts of things, including marketing services to people which are not appropriate. You have the opportunity to manipulate their data. And then to come back to the question of elections, we all vote. You know, I think ordinary people are very concerned about their right to vote and making sure that is safe. And that's very much an issue around personal data. And I think people are also more and more concerned, and this is people who do have bank accounts and do have, you know, store accounts. So it's maybe not people who are the most poor. But people are concerned about things like identity theft and fraud. So there's a whole range of issues that I think people instinctively know are important to them, which is why they get so upset when there are things like data breaches. And I think it can just be a question of education and saying to people, well, that's why this act is important. You know, your right to privacy is important, but this act actually gives effect to it. So that's why you need to know a bit more about this.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tilly. My second question is, what is it that POPIA aims to do?
I think Papua's main aim is to protect the right to privacy, but a very particular part of the right to privacy. So what they call informational privacy. And what that really means is to say that your personal information is part of you. It's not something that you can sell or give away. It's like your eyes or your kidneys, and you have to be protected, and that part of you has to be protected. And that's really what Poppy is trying to do, is trying to protect that aspect of you and make sure that that is kept safe.
Great. Just one more. What is the special personal information and why is it treated differently?
Well, I think the reason it's treated differently is because it's felt to be particularly dangerous. That if you are looking at, and I assume we're talking now about things like your trade union membership and your religion and those categories of information. The reason is because those are seen to be particularly vulnerable to abuse, and that those databases have to be treated particularly carefully, which isn't to say the other ones shouldn't be treated carefully, but you have to look at those mindful of all of the consequences that there can be if you have, you know, medical information being made available, for example.
Great. Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks.
Thank you. You still had a half a minute left. Would you want to proceed?
I don't think I'm going to be able to ask a question in half a minute. It's fine. Thanks.
Okay. I think that would be loaded to which member? Which member would you want to donate your minute to?
Honorable Jayla.
Okay. Honorable Sart.
Thank you, Chair, and morning to Ms. Tilly. It's good to see you again. Can you hear me clearly? So may I just in general ask, there have been particular concerns expressed about communications surveillance, and then of course that links to the misuse of people's personal data. And you have touched on this already, but what more would you think can be done to prevent this, to address this? The legislation will be in place, and we know with communications surveillance there's other legislation, but obviously there are capacity constraints which might be beyond your control should you be appointed, such as law enforcement. What other mechanisms do you think can be used to assist in this regard?
Well, I think, and this may sound like a very obvious thing to say, but people need to be thinking about personal information as something that is valuable. So when you come into a building and somebody says to you that they want to know your name and your ID number and your car registration number and your address and your telephone number, and you've got to put that all in the book in order to be allowed into the building, I think what we need to know, or what those people need to know, is that the person who is having to fill in that sort of register must be thinking about how important that information is, and asking questions about why they should be giving all of that information at that point. And the person who is managing that also really needs to think about how important that information is and how it should be managed carefully. So I think there's a number of instances where we just sort of gather up personal information and we think it's for a good reason. And I don't think it always is. And I think that that's a good place to start, because if people start being more cautious about sharing their personal information and they start thinking about how important it is, then they'll get involved. And I think that's really what you need to see is a broad range of people who come from different places and different backgrounds saying, actually, my personal information is important. My right to privacy being respected is important. And I can get that done by, for example, complaining to the regulator.
Sorry to interrupt, but so you would you'd also agree then that education is hugely important of the general public in terms of this, and do you think that's a role that you'd be able to play in, should you be appointed?
Yes, I think that one of the things I've done is a plain language version. In fact, I did it for the Human Rights Commission, was a plain language version of the Access to Information Act. And I have to say, a plain language version of PUPI is very, very badly needed. I really think that would help. And then, you know, getting people involved in taking their own personal information seriously, I think that those are things that could be done. And mindful of the Honourable Member Jayanti's point, can be done at very little cost, really inexpensively.
Absolutely. And so with the global spread of COVID-19, that's generated numerous privacy, data protection and compliance concerns. I mean, I had that personal experience where it was on national television that I was tested positive and I hadn't even been tested yet. So one response to curb the spread of COVID-19 is contact tracing. And you identify, you monitor individuals who are coming in contact with an infected person. But obviously there are some data protection concerns in this regard in particular and generally in respect of the COVID-19 pandemic. And what are your thoughts in that regard?
I think the revised regulations that were introduced, which also introduced the COVID judge, so Judge O'Regan, Justice O'Regan taking on that role, paid a lot of attention to the data protection issues. And I think that the COVID app that you can put on your phone has been done really cleverly, because my understanding, and I've sort of spoken to people who know more about this than I, but that really is able to give you a notification of people who have tested positive for COVID without compromising your personal data. So I think that there are tech solutions that allow you to make sure that people are notified that they've been in touch with somebody who has COVID, because I think that's the thing that the doctors are telling us, you know, that we have to do to contain the spread. So obviously, as well as wearing a mask and washing your hands, but I think the responses have been measured and appropriate.
Thank you.
Yes, I think
thank you.
We have a quarter.
Thank
session.
You, Mr. Lee. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Honorable Nomathemba Jele, you had 5 minutes plus half a
thank
second.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Ellison, do you believe that commencement of certain sections of PAIA can create new economic opportunities for South Africa?
That's such a great question. Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's been frustrating is that we're in the same time zone as Europe, and we would be the perfect place to do a lot of data processing and running call centers because we're in the same time zone. One of the issues has been that we don't have our legislation in operation yet. So there are all sorts of rules about EU data not being allowed. You can't let it leave the EU unless it goes to a country that has appropriate safeguards. And we could have appropriate safeguards if we put our legislation into operation. And I think once we do, there's a good opportunity to make sure that European jurisdictions hear about that. They know that there's legislation in place, there's a regulator in place, and that there are opportunities to do their data processing here that we would have the correct regulatory framework. So, yeah, I definitely think there are opportunities there.
Okay, thank you. And another one is public awareness later. The regulation is very critical on this one. How would you ensure that you reach all South Africans in far areas than urban areas? I think that also you are doing this part-time. Thank you.
Well, I'm a great believer in radio. I think radio is a really good way to reach people who are not in urban areas. So I think that's one thing that's also very inexpensive, and radio stations need content, they need news, they need stories, and so that's a good option. I think working through local government is also really important. A lot of the information that people want is really about what is right next to them. So why is this road not tarred? Why is that dam not finished? Why is this housing development not proceeding? And a lot of that information is directly available from local government. So the more you work with local government explaining that they need to proactively make information available, I think the more people then understand that they have the right to that information. And I think if you can get that understanding working, I think local government has really been a missed opportunity. Well, it's certainly an opportunity that I think would be really important to try and exploit.
Okay, thank you. I think the last one about the very same local government. Mm-hmm. Some of the issues have already mentioned on the local government. Next year we're having elections. Lots of personal data, digital campaigning will be used, obviously. And now, and this data must be processed lawfully. So what is your view on that?
I think that's incredibly important. Personal data we've seen has been abused in other jurisdictions in order to influence the outcome of elections. And that is something that we need to be paying attention to here. My understanding is that the IEC and the information regulator have been discussing it. And I think that will be an important thing to really make sure that everybody agrees what needs to be done. And then you need to have the discussions with those service providers. And I mean, obviously, Facebook would be an obvious place to start.
Okay. I think the last one now. What is the main threat or risk of individuals on their personal information? That is the last one.
I'm sorry, I missed that. The threat to? Sorry, I didn't quite hear the question. The
what?
To?
Oh, the main...
It's 11 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Or risk of individuals. On their personal information.
I think the main risk, and we've seen it over the last couple of weeks, are big data breaches, where personal information is clearly, not only there's a data breach and it's made public, but it's also made public what the problems are in those people who are supposed to be looking after that information, and they're not looking after it properly. And I think that's the big risk, because that data set then can be abused and used in the wrong way. And so that's something that's very important to look at.
Thank you very much. Honorable Jackie Mofokeng.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Ms. Tilly. I want to check with you, as you have indicated that there's been a lot of happenings in the data, that is the information. I want to check how many credit bureaus we have in our country and how many are of South African origin. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I'm afraid I can't answer the question in the sense that I don't know how many credit bureaus there are. There are a number of credit bureaus, and my understanding is that a number of them are global companies. What they generally do, these companies, is that they try and find one regulatory standard. So if they're operating out of Europe, then they'll use the European rules for all of their companies around the world, all of their subsidiaries. That can be quite a good thing because the European system is very good. If they are, however, using the American system, that's bad because that's not a good regulatory framework. So I think that's all I would be able to say about credit bureaus.
Thank you, Ms. Tilly. Ms. Tilly, as you have actually answered on that, the follow-up will be, don't you think it's high time that South Africa must have its own credit bureaus, noting that the Home Affairs is having the very same information they are using, and people are paying companies instead of making sure that the money remains in the country? Don't you think there should be a relationship with the Department of Home Affairs?
Well, there definitely should be South African credit bureaus. I think that is absolutely true. I think we have a bit of a problem right now because we don't have the right law in operation, and I think that's what we're waiting for. So for next year in June, when the Protection of Personal Information Act comes into operation, what will happen then is that we really will have the right regulatory framework, and those companies will then be able to do their work properly in South Africa. They can, what some people are doing now is using the law now, even though it's only going to come into operation next year. So they're acting in accordance with the legislation, and that's probably, you know, that's good. That's a good thing to do. But I would really like to see that legislation come into place, because then our companies will be in a position where they can say, look, you know, this is an internationally, it's of international standard. This legislation is good legislation, and we can process our information in terms of it, and it will be absolutely safe to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Chair, do I still have a minute?
Yes, you do.
Okay. Thanks. Ms. Tilly, what do you think should happen to what happened at Experian? What do you think should happen to them because they have breached, you know, a very important part of the information of the citizens? There should be something that should happen in this country to stop them or stop any other person in future.
Yeah, Honourable Member, I agree. The difficulty has been with the legislation not operational. The regulators really had their hands tied. So that's a very good example of, and I mean, this is just on my knowledge of it, and I'm an outsider and I don't know the ins and outs, but it did seem to be a situation where there really was negligence in information being passed to a third party where it probably shouldn't have been. And that would be a very good example of where the regulator should be able to step in and should be able to levy a fine. So if that was the case, and I'm not saying it was, because as I say, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but the regulator would be in a position to do something like levy a fine. And that's exactly, you know, the reason that this legislation really does need to come into operation, is to make sure that if something like that happens, that it's then stopped.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. There was still a minute left. If out of interest, you said that there are two regimes, the European regime, which you think is good, and the American regime, which you think is not so good. What is not so good about the American regime? What is the difference between the two regimes?
Well, I think the difficulty for the Americans is that they don't have a federal privacy law. So there is no law that actually sets a standard across the all of the different states in America. So there's some places where there are good privacy protections, but there's no legislation which protects privacy across America. And that's something the Europeans have actually said they're so unhappy about it that they don't want to send their personal information to America because they feel it's so open to abuse in that framework.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Tilly. Two questions generally as a chair. Did you find the questions to be fair? Would you say the interview was fair or not fair?
I hope we did not forget Mr. Horn.
Oh, sorry, Honorable Horn. Sorry, my apologies, thousand apologies. Honorable Horn, you have your 5 minutes plus half a minute donated to you by Honorable Glenys Breytenbach. Thank you very much, Honorable Janji, for being Honorable Horn's advocate.
Yeah, that's a first, really.
There's going to be more. I need to assist them. They just...
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Ms. Tilly, in your introductory remarks, you made mention of necessary amendments to the Access to Information Act. What do you think is the most pressing issues that needs to be addressed, given, as you said, it's been drafted quite a while ago?
Well, I think thank you for that question. I think the key part of the act that really needs to be rethought is the idea of the proactive release of information. And I think it's come up in the My Vote Counts case, in which there's a particular category of information that the court has said should be made proactively available. But I think that must lead us to look at other kinds of information that should be proactively made available. And I think if we can, if we could start thinking about those and thinking about the categories of information that different departments hold and what would be, you know, what would be sensibly and easily made available online, because that's the key difference, is that when PIO was written, the main way that information would be shared with you is literally a photocopy. So somebody would have to stand in front of a photocopier and photocopy the document. Whereas now we have a completely different environment in terms of technology. And exploiting that would then make operationalizing PI so much easier, because you then don't have to make the request in the first place because the information is already available.
Thank you. You talked also about the exploitation of personal data, and there's been made mention quite a bit about personal data and next year's election.
Mm.
And I get the sense, and you've been at more or less all of those appearances, that currently the information regulator is still, and on the one hand one can understand it, very much at the stage where, if you talk of campaigns and elections, that where they want to police, for example, if, let's say, us as the Democratic Alliance take to the streets to do door-to-door canvassing, how are we processing and protecting the personal information we already have on the one hand, and which we then source from voters during our engagements? The difficulty is, however, and you did touch a bit on it already, is that there is also a second level, a more advanced level of personal information being used more and more during election campaigns. Do you see the current act being sufficient in enabling the information regulator to deal with those, let's say, more sophisticated harvesting of personal information? And with that, I don't mean necessarily ID and contact number, but rather what my interests are and that type of thing.
Mm. No, I think the way Poppy was drafted does it's broad, and it does, I think it is able to deal with the questions of the abuse of personal data in order to influence people in elections. So I think the hardware is there in terms of the legislation, but the difficulty is if you look at who the companies are that are doing that, they are the biggest companies in the world. And I think that's, we're starting from a real disadvantage in terms of being able to engage with companies like Facebook. But I think we're not doing it alone. I think there are many countries across Africa who are concerned about these issues and who want to engage with these issues. So, you know, there are also associations of the agencies around the world that deal with data protection. I think that's another option. So there's ways of trying to level the playing field in engaging with the companies who are using that information, as well as finding ways to see when it's happening, because that's also a really important part of it, is being able to diagnose that it is happening at any particular time and then trying to intervene and stop that. And for that, we need people who have the right IT skills. And that's something that I think we don't have many of in the country, you know, let alone in regulators. So I think that's a bit of a gap that we'd really have to think about how to make sure that those people can be drawn in quickly when there is a concern.
Okay, may I ask you in follow-up, look, historically, political parties has been wanting to talk to what we call our audience. Mm. So if one, for example, could talk about our colleague on the committee, the Honourable Swart, it may be the simplest issue. He is a member of a Christian Democratic Party, so preferably they in campaigning would want to talk to Christians. And the same applies more or less to all political parties. To what extent, where do you ultimately, if you to become part of the information regulator, when do you breach or act inconsistent with the law if you make use of big data in identifying your audience, specifically if that big data is readily available? You talked about Facebook. Where's that line?
Honorable Swart, Honorable Juan, your time is up.
Thanks.
No, thank you very much. It will be difficult to get the answer because I think you have exceeded your time. Ms. Tilly, did you find the questions to be fair? What is your view about the interview?
I would say that the questions were fair. And I would also say that the way the interview is structured is very fair, so that each member has the opportunity to ask two or three questions and everybody has the same amount of time. So based on looking at the JSC interviews, I would have to say that this interview compares very favorably with the JSC interviews in terms of fairness.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anything that you would want to tell the committee to declare, which if you are appointed and it's revealed might put you in a bad light and affect the reputation of the institution?
No, Chair. I've made all the disclosures I should. I should just mention I'm a member of the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution. I'm on their board, and I didn't put that in my CV.
Thank you very much for accepting to be part of the information regulator and availing yourself for the interviews. As you know that our program is very tight, but we would ensure that we communicate our decision as soon as possible.
That's great. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I wouldn't say Moi Lop because you're at home. Have a good day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shall I leave the meeting now?
Yes.
I'll do that. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much. So we are 11:17 now. Can it start at 11:20 with the next candidate? Committee Secretariat, can you contact the second candidate? Who is the second candidate?
Chairperson, the second candidate is Prof. Justice Pitlow, and she has connected.
She has connected, okay. So which means we can start immediately.
Okay, good. I'm very relieved. Sorry, Zoom calls have a habit of either the video doesn't work or the sound doesn't work or both. So I'm very pleased. And so far, the Wi-Fi is holding up, so that's good. You're all very clear. My name is Justine Limpetlaw, and I have two main roles in my professional life. I act as an independent legal consultant on a range of issues that are relevant to the information regulator, including electronic communications, access to information, privacy and data protection. And I am also I hold a research position as a visiting adjunct professor at the Link Center, which is a specialized unit within the Faculty of Humanities that looks at essentially fourth industrial revolution issues relating to electronic communications, policy, law, and regulation. I have a long association with issues around access to information. 2 years after I completed my LLB degree at WITS, I was invited back by the Center for Applied Legal Studies to work on a specialist project in light of our new constitution, then the interim constitution's right of access to information, to draft proposals for South African access to information law. And that eventually became, those proposals were fed into the task team that was at that time headed by Deputy President Thabo Mbeki, and that became our PIA legislation. I would be enormously pleased 16 years on to be able to, it's much more than 16 years. It's nearly 36 years. Sorry, I was counting from 2000. 36 years on to be able to serve on the information regulator. I don't know if you'd like more information about me, and well, maybe I can talk about the particular skills that I think I would bring to the information regulator. Would that be in order, Chair?
Yeah, you can proceed. You still have 2 minutes.
Okay. So the three key contributions that I can make are that I have extensive drafting experience, both of statutory provisions as well as regulations and reports, books, and both here in South Africa, but in other countries too. Just in the last 2 weeks, UNESCO has asked me to make myself available to draft the access to information laws for Sudan, which, as you know, has recently undergone a significant transition. I also think that it's critical to bring expertise around international trade and the economic impact on trade of data protection laws. And while laws such as the European Union's GDPR do not directly apply to South Africa, they do have to apply to companies that European companies do business with where personal data is being transferred to a third country. And I don't think that we've paid enough attention to the trade implications of these laws. And I think that we need to be very careful to make sure that our laws are able to integrate well with other countries' legal provisions in order to facilitate international trade, particularly in respect of electronic communication. And then lastly, my academic and my professional focus on electronic communications means that I have a sound understanding of the importance of universal, accessible broadband internet to realize the promise of the fourth industrial revolution. And just as the internet really paves the way for a realization of the rights of access to information, they also present significant dangers to the right of privacy, which our constitution also guarantees. And these rights have to be balanced appropriately. And I see those as being challenging tasks of the information regulator looking ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Honorable Ngola.
Thank you very much, Chair. Prof, according to the Act, a person appointed to be a member of the regulator must be a fit and a proper person.
Yes.
Do you believe that you are a fit and a proper person? And what are the key characteristics of a fit and a proper person?
Thank you for that question. I think I can say without hesitation that I'm a fit and proper person. And it isn't just a question of meeting the eligibility criteria that are set out in the Act. The issues about not having been convicted of an offence or not having been found wanting in relation to trust and candor or being an unrehabilitated insolvent. Obviously I'm none of those things. I meet the qualifications. But more importantly, I have a lifelong commitment, or at least since my very first year, in fact, my last years at high school, to democratic principles and values, and in particular to our constitution. I have been involved in many important legal matters in South Africa involving not only access to information, but also freedom of expression. And I think that those values and generally a human rights perspective on our laws, on privacy, on surveillance, on access to information and making those meaningful is essential on the information regulator.
Okay, Prof.
Sure.
My second question is, I'm still on podium. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. It was buffering a bit, but I can hear you. Yes.
All right. It is common cause that there is a ongoing discussion within the South African government on the fourth industrial revolution. Do you believe that the information regulator should be included in that discussion by government about the digital economy and the fourth industrial revolution? If your answer is affirmative, why do you think it is important for the regulator to be included in those discussions of government?
I think it's absolutely essential for the regulator to be involved in full IR discussions. And I think that the regulator needs to be brought in along with other regulators, obviously such as ICASA, as well as the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies, and a host of others, to really try and ensure that the fourth industrial revolution becomes a reality in South Africa. And I just want to say, Mr. Nola, that I think it's a term that's often bandied about and not well understood. Merely accessing the internet, merely being able to use online tools the way that we are today, for example, what we're doing now is not 4IR. What we're doing now really is 3IR. But very many people in our country don't have access to the basic tools that allow them to participate in, to engage with technology, much less engage in 4IR activities, which is about integrating a range of technologies with applications to drive economic growth and development, particularly in services and the knowledge economy, but not only. So given the central role in legislation, both in terms of the Protection of Personal Information Act, but also in terms of PIA, the Promotion of Access to Information Act, of the information regulator, I don't see how it would be possible to leave the information regulator out of government policy and discussions and decision making if you want a truly integrated approach to the fourth industrial revolution, which is the only approach that is going to drive social and economic development going forward.
Thank you very much. Honorable Glenis Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Professor.
Hello.
If you are appointed, does your interest lie with data protection or access to information or both, and why?
That's a very interesting, that's a very good question, if I may say so, Ms. Breiten, Advocate Breitenbach. The it's one of the reasons that I was so delighted that Northeast where Madlala Rutledge contacted me and asked if she could nominate me for a part-time position. And that's because it's only the part-time positions on the information regulator that enable you to do both. I think it's Section 43(2)(b) specifically says that you can perform functions in terms of both access to information and data protection and protection of personal information under POPI. To be honest, one of the big attractions for me about being on the information regulator at this time is its leadership. I've worked with Advocate Pansy Tlakula on a number of projects and issues when she was the special rapporteur for freedom of expression for Africa, and I have huge regard for her. So I would like to make my services available, legal, policy, otherwise, wherever there would be a good fit. And frankly, I think that I have the expertise to straddle both of the pieces of legislation that fall within, you know, that set out the powers and the responsibilities of the information regulator. So I would see myself very much as being a sort of foot soldier, as it were, under the chairperson's direction about what the central issues are facing the information regulator, whether those come in terms of the POPIA Act or the PIA Act.
Thank you. I have a second question. On the 1st of July 2020, the remaining sections of POPIA became effective, but there is a grace period of 1 year for responsible parties to become compliant.
Yes.
If you are appointed, you will join the regulator at a time when it must shift its focus from capacitation to implementation.
Yes.
How do you think you'll be able to contribute here?
So there are a couple of ways in which I'd be able to contribute. One is, first of all, I am a lawyer in private practice. I am very used to being able to work on an urgent basis and being very careful with my time. I can work exceptionally quickly, which I think is going to be essential in the next year. I am also very much a results-driven person. I don't believe in spending endless hours in committee talking about things without getting things done. And I have a lot of experience of this in terms of establishing academic courses and negotiating a university bureaucracy in order to make courses happen and to establish academic whether it's certificate courses or degree courses. I have a lot of experience working with the communications regulator, with other institutions such as the Film and Publications Board. I have often appeared in Parliament. I'm used to working with a broad range of stakeholders in the interest of getting things done. And what I know about the current chairperson, Advocate Tlakula, is that she is also someone who is interested in seeing things getting done and getting progress. This law has been on our statute book for a number of years now. It's time that it was actually implemented. I'd like to help with that.
Thank you very much, Professor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. You have 15 seconds extra. So would you
want to... I was going to go to Janky this time.
Oh. Honorable Janky, you have 5 minutes, 15 seconds donated by Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach, for that generosity. Professor, in this 5 minutes we have, what in your view are the key challenges or risks facing this emerging information regulator as it is being set up? I'm not looking for a wish list. Please give me two that you know.
So, may I speak candidly with you, Mr. Yankees?
As long as you're going to give me that two, because I'm controlling my time.
I understand.
Thank you.
We in South Africa specialize in world-class statutes that suffer from insufficient implementation. We also suffer from having a legislation that where there is a mismatch with conditions on the ground. And that is something that I would very much like to assist the regulator in. There is no point in having a Rolls-Royce law if the vast majority of businesses simply ignore the law. That is going to be a huge challenge for the regulator to make sure that there isn't just a thin crust of compliance by companies, for example, on the stock exchange, and yet the vast majority of processes of personal information somehow find themselves entirely unregulated and there's no enforcement of the provisions. I think that is a critical issue.
Help me there. What is your two challenges that you have identified? Just be specific. In relation to information regulator, I don't want us to go to South Africa, but here
sure.
On the information regulator.
Yeah, okay. So one of them is
there are provisions around codes of conduct, for example, that all people either have to, that companies and entities either have to comply with the code of conduct that is established by the regulator and be regulated by the regulator, or there has to be a self-regulatory body that whose code of conduct in relation to personal information processing is done by that body. I want to see those implemented properly and thoroughly, but not just accepted and approved, but actually checking up to make sure that those self-regulatory bodies are working.
How would you mitigate that risk or challenge?
I think it's through setting up a database of exactly who is doing self-regulatory work, and then making sure that people on occasion, obviously it's not all the time, it's not possible to monitor that all the time, but for the information regulator to get in there to attend hearings and make sure.
Thank you. Let's pause there. I'm controlling my time. I want to go to my next question. Thank you. Now just tell me very briefly, how would you probably have done the research? We are operating in a very constrained environment. We don't have a budget for this information regulator. And yet we must pursue and achieve its mandate. If you are appointed, how are you going to assist to ensure that we achieve that particular mandate, and what kind of innovative strategies would you bring on board in an environment of almost no budget?
That's a very broad and difficult question, Chair. The fact of the matter is that I've accepted nomination to this, knowing that, for example, understanding that there is not a big budget, I have remained available for this position, even during COVID-19, where, like everyone else in the country, I can see government's budgets being stretched. I don't know exactly how the information regulator is going to weather that storm. What I can say is that I am used to, particularly in my work on limited budgets, I'm used to trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, and I will give my all to Pansy and to the other people on the regulator to make it work.
Before you go to Pansy, I don't want you to go to Pansy. Give me one example of an innovative example of how you are going to ensure that you're going to operate with the little that you have and make this institution successful. It's not going to be on personal issues. It's going to be the practical example.
The single most important thing for guaranteeing enforcement on a limited budget is to use technology properly. Is to use technology to do the work of setting up technological systems for assisting in monitoring and compliance enforcement. And I will be working with technologists and with the information regulator to set
Thank
up those
much.
Systems that Thank function.
Thank you very much, Rob. I pause there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. You still had 30 seconds left. The next person will be Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Professor. Professor, firstly, there have been a number of concerns expressed about communication surveillance in general and misuse of people's personal data. And you have indicated in your last response the mismatch with legislation, conditions on the ground, a Rolls-Royce law that is ignored. And I think that is a challenge that faces us continually as legislators. We pass very good laws, but the implementation is the challenge. So in your view, though you touched on it, I'd like you just to broaden how you would deal with that from a regulatory perspective, should you be appointed, given also in mind that there are the capacity constraints where there are breaches of the law, law enforcement in those regards. Can you give me an indication of how you'd address that?
So I think that there are two issues with that. One of them is that as the law becomes implemented, it's very clear that secondary legislation, so regulations, guidelines, that sort of thing are going to become critical. This law is simply not going to be implemented properly if those are hugely voluminous, very complicated, with a significant regulatory impact or difficulty in compliance and complexity in compliance. So I would like to be able to bring to the information regulator an ability to draft simple, short regulations that are easy for ordinary people to follow. If this act is going to be implemented properly, you are not going to have to, you're not going to be able to have a lawyer at your side. If you have to have a lawyer in attendance to be able to comply with the act and the regulations, I don't think we're going to be able to get the compliance that we need given the broad application of the law. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I think it's going to be important to make sure that the information regulator builds links with law enforcement or through the Justice Department and the police and others to assist in providing training on law enforcement officers to be able to deal with offences that arise under this law. Because if we cannot enforce the offences provisions of the law, I think it's unlikely that the other provisions will be able to be enforced either. And the only way of doing that is through sufficient training and education of law enforcement on this particular narrow area of law.
Thank you. I think that's very valid. I'd like you to just comment also on the COVID-19, the global spread of COVID-19, and the numerous privacy, data protection, and compliance concerns. I had COVID-19. It was broadcast all over television before I was even tested that I had it, just as an example of such a breach. But one of the responses globally to curb the spread is contact tracing. Mm. As you know, the identifying and monitoring individuals who have come into contact with infected persons. And obviously, there would be concerns of data protection where you identified in the COVID-19 pandemic. How would you balance the interests of health with privacy given the COVID-19 pandemic?
That's a very interesting question, Mr. Swart. And I have to say that I've been approached a lot on the Department of Health's own contract tracing app. Now, I'm not a technology, I'm not an electronics engineer, I'm a lawyer. But from what I can see about that app, and I use it, it's on my phone, is that it certainly does collate information about you, but it doesn't distribute your personal health details and your personal details to people on that app. What it does do through the algorithm is to alert people that your phone has been in contact with, that they have been in contact with a COVID-19 positive person. I think there's been a huge amount of disinformation about the track and tracing app that we use and elsewhere overseas. And I think that disinformation does us all a disservice. So yes, those issues do need to be balanced. There are far more worrying surveillance issues, as we saw in the Amambongani case before the Gauteng High Court, than our COVID-19 track and tracing app, in my view. I think it's an excellent one. I think the government response is good.
Chair, I don't know how much time I've got left, but just that particular issue relating to illegal surveillance and dealing with that, would you just comment on how you would improve the regulations of illegal surveillance that takes place?
So that's an interesting point. Of course, the information regulator does not have jurisdiction over the Interception and Monitoring Act. So I mean, my own view is that it's going to be important going forward for the information regulator to be consulted, for example, by the National Communications Center, whose activities were found to be invalid and unconstitutional by that High Court. Obviously, the matters, I understand it's under appeal, so we'll need to see where it ends up. But in the long term, it is going to be essential.
Thank you, Professor. Sorry, my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Prof. Justine.
Hello.
In your view, especially in plain language, so that people on the ground can understand, why is there a need for legislation to protect personal information?
Because we are living in an information age. And they say that 10 Facebook posts tells Facebook more about you than your spouse knows. And in this age, there are very real dangers about losing our personal privacy. They're not just the obvious ones, such as bank details and credit card details that can lead to fraud, but more important ones about our rights to be forgotten on the internet and our rights to not have all websites caching information about us to sell to other people without our consent. And in this regard, we're dealing with enormous companies, very often multinational companies. And they require legislating, because we are insufficiently strong as individuals to be able to protect our own privacy, not only from governments, but from these kinds of companies, as well as obviously from organized crime.
Thank you. What exactly is POPIA's aim? What does POPIA exactly aim to do?
I think that it aims to protect people's privacy, and it enables people to be able to correct incorrect information that is held about them by data processors, whether public or private. It also gives individuals a much greater measure of control through the consent obligations in POPIA to be able to say, I'm happy for you to pass on my personal details. I want to receive, for example, marketing and related information in particular areas, but not in others. Or I want to allow for that access to my information now, but in 2 years' time, I've changed my mind. I don't want to allow that. I think that those kinds of people-centered privacy tools are one of the most valuable aspects about POPIA.
Thank you. What is meant by special information and why is it treated differently? Special personal information.
I have the act here, but I'll be honest with you, I don't know that term offhand. I can see that it's specifically referred to in section 26. Okay, sorry, Chair. Can I just say very quickly, it's clear that this is the thing that goes to the heart of us as individuals, and it's not just information around our spending habits or our searches. It's information about who we intrinsically are, whether that's religion or beliefs, or whether or not we're a member of a trade union, race, gender, etc., our sex life or biometric information. Now, of course, biometric information is particularly important to protect because it can be used in ways that are extremely untoward, including criminally.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Honorable Nebot Drachens. Honorable Numa Chamba-Jale.
Thank you, Chair. Do you believe that the commencement of certain sections of POPIA can create new economic opportunity for South Africa? It does?
Yes, definitely. One of the ways that... Sorry, I can no longer see you on the screen, but I'm going to answer the question. Is that right, Ms. Jele?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. One of the ways that it does this, and let's be clear that sometimes there are, you know, there are always new economic opportunities created by people that have to, you know, for people that have to either implement the law or who are then employed, for example, to help a company manage the law. But those are, for me, those are less important than the kinds of economic opportunities that come through further investment and reindustrialization and the development of new economies. With the with this act now coming into force, South Africa has the kinds of laws that are recognized, for example, by the European Union as then allowing personal information to be processed in South Africa. So it allows for outsourcing economies to develop from European companies that may wish to expand their work, for example, in other countries. It facilitates trade with a far larger community where data protection is required for companies to do business, for example, in South Africa. So I think I was very pleased at the coming into force of the new sections, and looking forward to in a year's time having the whole act being fully implemented.
Okay. Public awareness and education on the role of this regulation is very critical.
I'm sorry, Chair. I'm the I can't hear the question. The audio seems very bad. Can you assist me?
Honorable Jala? Honorable Jala?
All South Africans.
Honorable Jala?
More areas than urban.
Honorable Jala?
Yes, I can hear you. I can hear you.
We can't hear you.
I can hear you. You don't hear me?
We can't hear you. Your bandwidth is low.
Okay, go to the next one, Chair.
But you're now back. Can you repeat the question?
My question was public awareness and education on the role of this regulation is very critical. So I wanted to...
You must switch off the camera and then she'll be better.
Honorable Jale, can you switch off the
camera? No. How are you going to reach those
people
who are far from the...
I got the gist of the question. I'd like to try and answer it if I may. And if I leave anything else, then Honourable Member Jelle can tell me if I've left something out. As I understand the question, she's stressing the importance, and I think it's an excellent point, about the need for public education awareness on people's rights and on the implementation of the Act. And in particular, she's saying...
You can answer.
No,
okay, thank you. And what she's saying is that how are you going to ensure that public awareness isn't just something that happens, for example, in urban areas or where people have, for example, access to the ready access and easy access to the internet. And Chair, this is one area that I believe passionately in. It's always been a feature of my work that I've combined teaching and research along with my professional work, precisely because I think that public education issues are important. I think it's going to be essential, not only through, for example, opinion pieces in newspapers, but also critically to work with a public broadcaster, both on radio and on television, to be able to make programming aware and to be able to slight programming that as a sort of public service programming that helps people navigate these kinds of critically important pieces of legislation, which are very complex for an outsider to understand how they fit together. But unless people understand their rights, not only to data protection and personal privacy, but also to access to information, the laws will not be fully realized for the majority of people in the country. So I have, through my work as an electronic communication regulatory lawyer, I have very good understanding of the mandate of the SABC. I have good relations at the SABC, and I would like the information regulator to work with the public broadcaster to make that kind of education available as audio or audiovisual material that is flighted on the public broadcaster. Because let's face it, that has the broadest reach of any medium in the country.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mufokeng.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Professor. Professor, I want to ask you, how many credit bureaus do we have in the country? As you have noted that we have a lot of multinationals and then those that are South African origins also, how many do you know?
Are you talking just about credit bureaus?
Yes, I'm asking this because you remember what happened to Experian. Now the question is,
how many credit bureaus do we have in the country? And those are the South African origin, how many do you know?
Okay, I do not know.
Okay. I heard you saying that there are a number of multinational companies that are in this space. What were you meaning?
No, I wasn't talking about the credit bureau space. I was talking about multinational companies just through the I have to say I'm not aware. I'm aware that there are South African credit bureaus that work with banks. I'm not aware of international credit bureaus, for example, that that work here. The point that I was making was that large multinational companies that trawl the internet for our online information, organizations such as Facebook and Amazon and Google, the big search engines, those are the ones where I'm saying, because of the might of these organizations, they're largely unaffected often by local laws and regulations. And they require governments, not just acting as a single government, but I think this is where, for example, the African Continental Free Trade Agreement is going to be so important, to be for us to be able to operate as an African trading bloc in dealing with privacy and data protection, access to information concerns of these companies. I was not specifically, I'm sorry if that wasn't clear. I was not specifically talking about credit bureaus. And frankly, I find, I mean, the Experian leak is just really, you know, it's extremely problematic that that kind of information can get out. But unfortunately, this is a reality of our hyper-wired world, and it isn't just them. Capitec and other banks have also been the subject of these kinds of hacking, which is obviously a criminal activity. Okay. And we have to be able to deal with that.
Thank you, Professor, now that the experience, we have an experience of what happened with the Experian data breach, what do you expect South Africa to do? Because I'm aware that their information was coming from TransUnion. If you followed what was the discussion about Experian, it's getting its information from TransUnion. And TransUnion is a British company, and it has been. Now, I want to know that, do you think that it's high time that information regulators could advise government to say, we have Home Affairs, they have a lot of information, they can just add few things and have their wing to do the same thing and get rid of these other companies. Would you agree with me?
Honorable Mofokeng, I really don't want to venture into this territory because I was not involved in that matter. I read about it, not involved in that matter professionally. I don't know the ins and outs of the TransUnion versus Experian relationship or what TransUnion does or whether or not Home Affairs would be an appropriate vehicle to take over those obligations. I have to, on those specifics of these issues, this particular issue, I'm afraid I'm going to plead ignorance. Apologies.
Okay. Chair, do you have a minute or two?
No, you've exhausted your time.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chair. Professor, you talked about the disconnect and a disjuncture between the law and implementation. Currently, the regulatory powers in respect of the access to information still sits with the Human Rights Commission. And when they report to us at Parliament and in their annual reports as well, they have long lists of governmental institutions which do not comply with making, for example, available an annual report as to how they dealt with requests for access to information. You say that simple, short regulations should assist, but if I make the statement that there seems also to be a general unwillingness to properly embrace the duties placed on institutions by PAIA, what would your comments be, and how should the information regulator, when it now takes over that function, ensure better implementation?
I think that's an excellent question. Thank you, Mr. Horn. I also want to say that I don't think that government can expect the private sector to respond with alacrity on particularly promotion of access to information issues if it itself isn't doing so. There have been numerous cases, you can read them in the law reports, of institutions refusing access to information where they shouldn't have. But also, and I'm afraid I come across this very often in my work, manuals of public institutions that are out of date, where the contact details, the dead email address, for example, where time periods for responses are simply not complied with. And I think part of the problem is that we are not enforcing it. There are no consequences for non-compliance. Information officers are not facing the legal consequences for failing to implement their obligations under the Act. And I think, again, I think that we are going to have to work with law enforcement to make this a reality. I also think that we're going to have to do, as I said earlier, sort of spot monitoring, and to be raising where an information officer is not doing her job or his job, that in the end that's going to have to be raised with the head of the institution to take responsibility for. There have to be consequences for non-compliance. If government, and again, I think it's essential for government to lead on this, if public bodies are not complying with either POPIA or PAIA, POPIA or PAIA, I think that you can expect similar desultory compliance from the private sector.
Thank you. You referred to the, let's say, the big international corporations. You mentioned Facebook, Amazon, and Google, and the fact that they also seems to an extent to act above the law. If you analyze POPIA, do you think, if we, for example, talk a moment about elections and the possible influence on even of the outcome of elections, do you think that POPIA is a suitable vehicle to address those, let's say, broad scale with a blanket type of approach, big harvesting of, as you say, not necessarily the obvious personal data, but rather the type of things people sometimes would want the internet to forget? Or do you think we need additional legislation to try and tackle the issue of manipulation through big data?
That's a very interesting point. I sit on the board of Media Monitoring Africa, and worked with them to set up their real 411 disinformation hotline that was flighted during the last national election, where the IEC worked closely with Media Monitoring Africa and others to try and stop disinformation before it, and worked with the big companies, Twitter, Facebook, Google, the big platforms here, to identify as soon as possible misinformation around the election that was coming out, and to work across the platforms with all stakeholders to shut it down. I actually think that this was a project, and it's continued to be a project during COVID, to counter misinformation. This is, in my understanding, one of the first places in the world where we had a multi-stakeholder approach to stopping disinformation and the kind of use of bots and similar technology to publish false information that could undermine an election. And I don't think that the country received nearly as much credit around that as it should have. It cannot be Pope Pierre alone. You've got to, in relation to elections, you have to involve law enforcement as well as the Independent Electoral Committee. And luckily, the Electoral Code makes those kinds of issues offences as well.
Thank you, Prof. Thank you very much. The time has been exhausted on this issue. Prof, is there any issue that you think that you would need to disclose if found out can put you in a bad light or affect the reputation of the institution that you did not disclose in your disclosure form?
No.
So you've disclosed everything. So there's nothing that you want to bring to our attention that you think that you found out it might put you in a bad light?
No. I would say, Chair, just if I was appointed and if an issue arose before the information regulator that I had worked on previously in a legal capacity or an academic capacity, I would, of course, inform my colleagues about that and would make that absolutely clear so that there could not be an undisclosed conflict or anything like that. I take those issues extremely seriously. I'm an officer of the High Court. I take those kinds of obligations extraordinarily seriously.
No, thank you very much. Your view about these interviews, do you think they were fair? Do you think the questions were fair and the proceedings were fair?
I think I've been very impressed by the entire process, particularly the helpfulness of Vonani, who's been in contact with us and has been extremely helpful. I found the whole process very thorough. I had questions come back about some of the documentation submitted that needed to be clarified. I felt that everyone had gone through a proper process to make sure that in getting to this stage that the right people were here. I have been very impressed, if not a little daunted, by the CVs of the other people on the shortlist. I think that you really have put together an extraordinary list of shortlisted candidates for the position. I think your timekeeping, Chair, has been excellent, if I may say so. And I found all of the committee members to be superbly prepared.
No, thank you very much, Prof, for making yourself available. We will contact you as soon as, in fact, we'll make a decision as soon as possible. You would know that we have a lot of work before the committee, the GPV bills and everything else. But we'll try to make a decision as soon as possible. Thank you very much for making yourself available.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Honorable members, do you want a 2 minutes comfort break or should we invite the next candidate immediately?
2 minutes comfort break, please, Chair.
About 2 minutes, we will start at 20.